It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine shares some science headlines with us, including new technology that could let scientists edit plant genes to protect against disease. First, Governor Walker visited Riverdale High School in Muscadet earlier today to sign a bill that will increase funding for many rural schools. The bill includes what's known as sparsity aid, which aims to target more money to districts that cover large areas with low populations. It would bump up this aid from $300 per student to $400 per student in those districts. The bill also increases the revenue limit for lower spending districts. Kim Kokel is executive director of the Wisconsin Rural Schools Alliance. Kim, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Glad to be with you.
Before we get to the specifics of what was just signed here, can you talk about the situation that a lot of these rural schools found themselves in when it came to funding?
Well, I think around the state right now, funding is very tight. This last budget helped a little bit with increase and has gained some funding back for us. The sparsity aid and the low revenue were key issues for our organization. Moving forward as we went into this last biennial budget. We thought everything was going to get through the Joint Finance Committee, and then at the last minute, some things changed, and both those issues were pulled in that final budget. But fortunately, we were able to get both those bills to come back around, with separate bills now, which the governor did sign today. With a few minor changes from what they originally were.
Let's break it down now and start with the sparsity aid side of it, Kim. It goes up from $300 to $400 per student, but tell us what sparsity aid is a little more and what it means.
Basically, sparsity aid will, for districts that are 745 or less, with a population of 10 students or less per square mile, can qualify for sparsity aid. And so what this bill does now, instead of those schools were getting $300 per student, they will now get $400 per student. So for a district that has about 300 some students, that's going to be about a $30,000 increase for their budget, which is a positive. One of the areas, as I said earlier, the original language that was in the budget that the governor had first recommended to the Joint Finance Committee also had a second tier that we had requested to increase that enrollment up to 1,000 students instead of 745. And the reason we asked for that is we've got a number of districts that meet all those qualifications of 10 students or less per square mile, but have, 2,000, 2,500 students, 1,500 students. So a lot of districts that could use that sparsity aid, are still locked out, but again, this is a good step. Actually, at the signing today, I did talk a little bit to the governor about, be nice to get back to some of that original language he put in there, and actually even looking at if we could, remove that enrollment requirement. So the districts that do meet the formula with that 10 students or less can all qualify.
Do those kind of districts face unique costs? I imagine right off the bat, transportation, if you're busing a wider area, picking up a few students in each place, that alone has got to be an additional expense for those districts.
Yeah, I mean, the busing alone is phenomenal. I'll use Rhinelander for a perfect example. They've got 2,464 students, six students per square mile, and they're busing, 385 square miles. Merrill's another one, 2,700 kids, 4.7 students per square mile, and they're busing close to 600 square miles. So, you just look at that square mileage, and you can already look at the increase that you're, paying for maintenance and fuel costs.
Talking to Kim Kokel, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Rural Schools Alliance, looking at two new pieces of legislation signed by the governor related to financing for especially rural schools. Kim, let's get to the other side of that now. The revenue limit increases. Now, this affects schools, low-spending schools, they're called, ones that were kind of locked in because of a previous law at a lower spending per student than other districts, right?
Correct. Yeah, these are districts that were being very frugal back in the 90s, And when the revenue caps came in and weren't lifted like they were supposed to be, if everybody remembers back to the 90s, the revenue caps were actually supposed to sunset, I think, within 5 years of when that first went into effect, but it never happened. So these districts that were being very frugal back in the 90s got locked into this low rev. Many of them are, only spending like $9,100 a kid right now. And so, you know, with inflation and costs and things like that, it's been really hard for them to keep up. And so this bill really, is a good step for, helping those low revenue districts. And you know, will allow them, you know, by the year 22-23 budget, to increase up to $9,800 per student.
I've heard, Kim, that schools in rural areas where the population overall, not just the student population, but the population is declining, it's also aging, there are fewer students. They're facing particular challenges because you still have to heat the whole school. You can't just heat a percentage of it. Do these changes affect those schools, those rural schools with declining populations in particular?
With the lifting that low revenue, it's going to help those districts where maybe they might have had to go to referendum for some of those issues. And in some cases now they may not have to go to referendum because of this bump that was given through this bill. I'm not going to say that it's going to stop all referendums because I still think we got a long way to go on funding before that's going to happen.
Yeah, the lawmakers have formed a blue ribbon commission on school funding to like look at this big, complicated picture, not just for rural schools, but for the whole state. What other kind of changes are you hoping for when it comes to funding for rural districts?
Well, a couple things that I think we would like to look at is, right now, a lot of the funding formula is based on property tax, and what we run into, especially in a lot of our rural areas, districts look like they're rich districts because of the property value, because it's recreational property, when in reality, most of those districts, the people that are living there year-round and the students going to those schools are high poverty. And so they're, because of that, using the property value, they're not really getting the money that they should get.
We'll leave it there for now, Kim. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you very much.
That's Kim Kokel, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Rural Schools Alliance, talking about new legislation signed into law today, raising funding for some rural schools around the state. First, biologists are using gene editing to armor plants against disease, which they say could be the key to the future of farming, but not everyone is on board. We'll look at the newest technology and other intriguing stories from the world of science with science writer Gemma Tarlak. Gemma is a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello, Rob. I hope you're hungry for science.
I am indeed. And before we get to the gene editing of that food, which we'll be hungry for, let's start by talking about this is a piece you wrote yourself, this really humble stuff called ochre, O-C-H-R-E. It's dirt. A kind of dirt, right, and rocks, but it could be
a kind of rock,
okay, and it's a key to the human story in a lot of ways. Tell us a little bit about ochre.
Yeah, well, ochre is basically defined as any really iron-rich rock. So it comes in a lot of different colors, yellow, purple, but red ochre is probably the most famous, and it is found all over the world in both a lot of modern cultures and also tons and tons of early human settlements and sites. And it's really exciting because in a lot of ways, the story of human evolution can be figured out by looking at ochre use, where it occurs, how it was used, what was left of it, and even talk about being hungry for science. There's even one theory that people who ate ochre, which some traditional cultures still do today, people who ate ochre were actually feeding their brains and boosting their nutrient intake, which may have led to the evolution of the modern human brain.
Now, ochre, you write, is often used as a pigment. The most famous one is red, though there are other colors of ochre. Does the color have a big significance as to why people were using it?
Yeah, and that's also another really interesting thing. You know, humans, like other old world monkeys and apes, we have trichromatic vision. We can look out on the savanna, on the plains, whatever, and in a carpet of green, we can see red. We could spot even just a tiny bit of red. If you think of how much a red cardinal stands out against the winter landscape, for example. And basically, this trichromatic vision, the ability to see red, really is linked, they think, to why red ochre was so prominently used in so many different areas of our evolutionary story, because it was a kind of, it was a way to signal to someone else. If you saw, you know, someone from maybe another settlement or another tribe or another group approaching you from a long distance away, if they were wearing red, that would signal, oh, this is, you know, this is one of my people. This is someone I can deal with. This is not necessarily an enemy. So they think that's one reason why we see so much red ochre use in the archaeological record.
Can we tell what kind of stuff people were doing with this ochre, the variety of things they might have used it for?
Yeah, well, you know, for decades, a lot of archaeologists and paleoanthropologists thought that it was used because it was red, because it was so visible over a distance. It was used as symbolic, as a way of communication. And also red is, of course, the color of blood and other things, so it also has a lot of symbolic value. But increasingly, just in the past couple decades, experimental archaeologists who actually try to create the stone tools and fire the Stone Age arrows, etc., to figure out how they were made and used, this branch of archaeology is actually finding that ochre appears to have been used as an adhesive, as a sunscreen, as an insect repellent, all these as a way to tan hides. All these really cool functional uses are just coming to light in the past decade or so.
And there's a deeper lesson here. You write, ochre, the use of ochre may be a symbol, a signal of an important stage in the development of our brains and how we interact with the world around us.
Yeah, exactly. And if you think about going back to the idea that someone would wear red ochre to be recognized from a long distance away by someone else, that implies a lot of things cognitively. One, it implies that you are putting this on to signal something, to communicate with someone who can read that signal and understand that communication. And it also implies you are on some level interacting socially with another group. And that implies all kinds of other things like trade and maybe, you know, the original social media network of just people going from one territory to another to exchange information and goods. And it's a really exciting hint of when modern human cognition was developing.
And we've used this phrase a lot in talking on this show, Gemma. This may, our study of ochre may push back the timetable for human development. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, there's new research coming out that suggests this kind of modern human behavior evolved hundreds of thousands of years earlier than one thought.
And what's the next step for research on ochre and human development?
Well, there are a lot of really cool directions that ochre is taking. I mean, this is really kind of a hot time for this field because there are all new ways of studying it, including figuring out if the ochre found in a cave in South Africa, say, came from the immediate vicinity of that cave, or if it came from 20, 40, 100 miles away. They can figure that out now based on the unique geochemical signature of the material. And you might think, oh, so what? Well, the fact is, if you have a piece of ochre or another material that came from hundreds of miles away, that means that you or someone in your group had to travel that far or interact with people who live there. So that, again, implies all kinds of social and trade networks, which in itself applies more advanced cognition. So this is one of the, and they're finding new ways of figuring out these geochemical signatures to determine where the material came from versus where it was actually collected. This is opening a whole new world into understanding how people used ochre.
And before we move on from ochre, you mentioned a possible nutritional angle. This is some iron-rich mineral. People may have been intentionally or otherwise eating some of it?
Yeah, you know, interestingly, there are some traditional cultures, particularly in Africa, where people, especially pregnant women, do still eat ochre, and they think it's because they're boosting their iron uptake. But there's one researcher who suspects that eating ochre, especially when ingested with seafood, which is rich in a lot of very great brain-boosting nutrients, that that combination actually may have put our species on the path towards developing the modern brains that we have. Now, I want to stress that this is very early research, and he's kind of an outlier. It has not been embraced by the field in general, but it's an intriguing look at how we may have gotten these big old brains that we're all walking around with.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, looking at some of the most intriguing stories in the world of science. Gemma, we've talked about CRISPR before. It's a gene editing tool, basically. Now scientists are trying to use it to protect produce crops from various kinds of disease. Let's first of all talk about the threat. A piece in Discover talks about orange crops, for example. There's some real threats to a lot of the food we count on.
Yes, you know, it's really shocking what's going on now in the citrus industry, and it's all because of this little bug that is carrying this bacteria that's causing citrus greening. This is a devastating disease, and just to give you an idea, in 1997, about 20 years ago, the annual haul of citrus crops from the U.S. was 244 million boxes. This year's predicted haul, 46 million boxes, which is the worst harvest since World War II. And it is largely due, some of it is Hurricane Irma, but it's largely due to citrus greening, which absolutely just, it devastates a tree. And now they're seeing citrus greening in just about every orange tree in those growing regions. It kills the tree within a couple of years, and in the couple of years of decline of the tree, it doesn't fruit, or the fruits are just misshapen and sour and basically not usable. So researchers are employing, again, this gene editing tool, CRISPR, to, instead of introducing, say, genes from another species, as is done with a lot of genetic modification these days, the idea with CRISPR is that it's so precise, you can go in and just knock out the gene that, say, is causing susceptibility to this disease, or you could even introduce a gene from another individual of the same species that has shown to be immune and shown to be successful against this disease. You could just kind of pop that gene right into the other individual. So it's a very precise and limited way of genetically addressing these susceptibilities to disease.
And federal regulations on this, I gather, are different since you're not taking something from another species and plugging it in. You're just doing it within stuff that's already in, say, the population of oranges. It's regulated differently than other what we call genetically modified organisms.
Yeah, because most of the genetically modified organisms out there are transgenic in that they will take, say, a snippet, and this is a gross oversimplification, but a snippet of fish DNA and stick it into a tomato, for example, because they want a certain trait in that tomato. That is not what CRISPR is. And because CRISPR is working within the individual organism or the individual species, it's not introducing any kind of exotic foreign material genetically, it is not considered transgenic, and it's actually not regulated. Right now, the government is taking kind of a hands-off approach because it does not involve this sort of exotic gene swapping that you see with other transgenic species.
And today, oranges, other crops that they're looking at doing this with?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's not just plants. A lot of it is crops, but I know they've used CRISPR successfully in pigs to make them immune to a pretty devastating disease. And they're also, you know, in addition to having these crops and livestock be less susceptible to disease, they're looking at ways to boost yield because, you know, we're going to have 10 billion people on the planet soon, and they all have to eat. And so they're looking for ways where they could create a new sustainable food system.
And finally, Gemma, you spent some time looking at 20 things we didn't know about diamonds. What struck you as most interesting about diamonds when you started digging in?
Oh, my gosh. You know, there is so much that's fascinating. I think one of my favorite things is, you know, the rain in Spain falls mainly on the plain, but on Neptune, it falls in the center of the planet. Neptune is one of several planets in our solar system that has diamond rain, which I think is really cool, and it forms a couple different ways, either within the planet's core or even atmospherically. And, you know, I was fascinated by the Hope Diamond. I think that's kind of the most famous diamond around. It's a blue diamond, which means it's got a couple boron atoms in there to give it its gorgeous color. And when it was first mined in India in the mid-17th century, it was almost three times its current size. So if you think about how big the Hope Diamond is today when you see it in those gorgeous museum displays, it was originally three times bigger, which is pretty impressive in my book.
And you mentioned the color of diamonds. It takes really just a very few atoms within a diamond to change it from, you know, a diamond that's completely colorless to something else.
Yeah, just a couple boron atoms, for example, in the Hope Diamond. And if you put a few nitrogen atoms in a diamond, it will actually make it appear yellow or brown, depending on how many atoms. But it takes a tiny, tiny, minuscule amount, which is also pretty fascinating.
And when did diamonds first end up on playing cards?
We don't know, but it was probably in the late 1400s. And I didn't know this either until I started doing my research, that playing cards were likely invented more than 1,000 years ago in China. And they followed the trade routes all the way first to Egypt and then into Europe. Originally, though, like for the Egyptians example, their suits on the cards were swords, wands, cups, and coins. And the Europeans started using those suits, but over time developed their own, of course, we know, clubs, spades, hearts, and diamonds. So that's a medieval creation that has a very long, much older history, which I think is really cool.
And finally, why are diamonds, briefly, Gemma, so hard?
Well, it is because of their crazy electron pairs. They form this, okay, so the five atoms form this tetrahedron, this very specific structure that actually they share electron pairs with each other. So that's why they are not just hard, but they are the hardest thing we know of, twice as hard as the closest competition, which is silicon nitride and cubic boron nitride.
Gemma, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine. She joins us about once a month to share some cool stories from the world of science. First, students from Parkland, Florida have planned a nationwide school walkout, met with many politicians, and have taken leadership roles in gun control activism in the last few weeks. Our next guest makes the case that if these students are politically engaged in activism, maybe they should also be allowed to vote. Lawrence Steinberg is a professor of psychology at Temple University and an expert on adolescence. He's the author of Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence, and his piece in the New York Times is Why We Should Lower the Voting Age to 16. Lawrence, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Well, tell us, Larry, about this idea of lowering the voting age. Make the case for that.
Well, there are a couple of different arguments in favor of it. The first is that if we look at the skills necessary to be an intelligent voter, it's quite clear that by the time people are 16, they're just as good or maybe just as bad as adults are. So I know that a lot of people are skeptical about extending the vote to people that young, but studies show that people that young can do it. But maybe more important is that we know that when people vote the first time they're eligible to vote, they're more likely to have the habit of voting in future elections. And studies that have been done in countries where they do permit people, 16 and 17-year-olds, to vote, find that their turnout is actually substantially higher than young adults' turnout is. So the idea here is that by allowing teenagers to vote when they're juniors and seniors in high school, we will help develop a habit of voting that will increase voter turnout in the future.
Now, an argument against this that you hear from people is, hold on, we don't let people drink until they're 21, for example. There are certain other limits on the age that people can do different things. And that's because teenagers, we know their brains are in some ways impulsive, more impulsive than grown-ups. You say, hold on, there's two different types of thinking involved here.
Right. So we, in psychology, we distinguish between what we call cold cognition and hot cognition. So cold cognition is the kind of thinking we do in situations where we have time to deliberate, to gather information, to weigh different points of view, and then to make a decision. Hot cognition is cognition that we use in situations that are emotionally arousing. Well, voting is clearly a cold cognition scenario. I mean, the campaign goes on for a long time. Some of us maybe think it's endlessly long. But you certainly have an opportunity to gather information, to discuss it with other people. And when you're in the voting booth, you can take as much time as you want. So teenagers are just as good as adults in cold cognitive situations. Where teenagers' judgment seems to be deficient are in those emotionally arousing situations. The other point to make here is that we don't have perfect alignment between the different ages that we use to decide when people have certain privileges and responsibilities. You mentioned that we don't allow people to purchase alcohol until they're 21, but we do allow people to drive when they're 16 years old. So clearly, we're able to tolerate different ages for different decisions.
You mentioned different countries having lower age limits. Talk more about what we know about how people under 18 participate and vote and their future political interests.
Well, most of the countries that allow people that young to vote are either in Europe or in South America. And there have been some studies that have compared the turnout of people that age with other age groups. As you may know, as your listeners may know, in the United States, the lowest turnout is among people who are between 18 and 24. But in studies that have compared 16 and 17-year-olds with that age group, they find that twice as many 16 and 17-year-olds vote as do people who are between 18 and 24. So people that age are eager to vote, and they use that opportunity when they have it. The other point that I didn't have space to make in the Times op-ed is that 16 and 17-year-olds are in school, so that it would be possible to tie in elections to civics classes, social studies classes, and so forth, which I think also will help promote voter turnout in that age group.
16 and 17-year-olds, when they can vote, are way more likely to vote than 18 to 24-year-olds. Do we have an idea why that is?
It's not clear. One reason might be that a lot of 18 to 24-year-olds are in college, and they may be going to college away from where their voting district is, and they may just not take the steps necessary to apply for an absentee ballot or to go home on election day. Another is that some people think that 16 and 17, that age is an age when people get really passionate about things, and that passion can be turned into participation in elections.
Talking to Larry Steinberg about lowering the voting age to 16 in the United States. He says, for the kind of thinking that goes into making a voting decision, yeah, you're pretty well developed at age 16, as good or bad as an adult would be. You can share your thoughts, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Larry, they had kind of an invitation to comment on your piece in the New York Times. They're shooting for younger people, and a lot of people, at least claiming to be 16 or 17, chimed in. Some loved the idea. Some said, I'm a 16-year-old. I'm interested in politics. I don't think we should be able to vote. We're maybe too emotional, maybe too able to be swayed by our friends on social media. What would you say to that?
Well, I'm not sure that that adolescents are too emotional to vote. As we were discussing before, voting is not one of those situations in which people's emotions drive impulsive behavior, because, as I said, the elections unfold over a long period of time. I think that, you know, the key issue really is not what adolescents are like, but whether in key ways they're different from adults. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of adolescents do use social media and could be swayed by social media, but a lot of adults use social media as well. So I think you always have to ask, not just are adolescents good enough or not good enough at these things, but compared to what? And when we compare them to adults, we don't see huge differences.
Yeah, in the article you write, and I think you're talking about cold cognition here, teenagers, I'm quoting now, teenagers may sometimes make bad choices, but statistically speaking, they do not make them any more often than adults do. Can you flesh that out a little?
Yeah, so when I get into arguments with friends about this issue, and I will say that a lot of my friends disagree with me about this, they will typically resort to anecdotes about some 16 or 17-year-old who's made a bad decision or who seems ignorant about the issues or so forth. And I will ask them if they don't know adults who make bad decisions or adults who are ignorant about the issues as well. And so the issue is, statistically speaking, if you pulled a random 16-year-old and a random, 25-year-old out, and you tested their abilities to make informed decisions, you wouldn't find consistent differences between those two age groups.
And this isn't completely unheard of in the United States. I think you mentioned in your piece that there's a place in Maryland, a city that permits 16 and 17-year-olds to vote. Now, that's just in local elections. Do we know, is that enough of a test case to know what happens there with younger voters?
Well, you know, we have to start someplace, and I think probably it's unrealistic to think that we're going to extend the right to vote to 16 and 17-year-olds on a national scale. But as you mentioned, Tacoma Park, Maryland, allows people that age to vote in local elections, and they have huge turnout among the 16 and 17-year-olds. San Francisco, during the last election cycle, had a referendum on the ballot there that would have permitted 16 and 17-year-olds to vote in local elections, and it lost by a couple of percentage points. So I think that there are a number of localities around the United States that are poised to do this, and I think we're going to see more and more of it. Now, you know that the op-ed was tied into the Parkland massacre, and but I have believed that we should lower the vote for quite some time now. But I do think I was inspired to write the op-ed after having witnessed so many students around the country coming forward and speaking intelligently and in a very informed and thoughtful way about gun control. And, maybe we should give the students who are in schools a little bit more say about policy.
We're talking to Lawrence Steinberg, professor of psychology at Temple University and an expert on adolescence. He's the author of Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. He's making the case to lower the voting age to 16 in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about 16-year-olds getting the vote in our elections? Do you have teenagers? Are you a teenager yourself? What do you think of the idea? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Lawrence Steinberg, professor of psychology at Temple University, author of Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. He's making the case, he wrote in a New York Times opinion piece, that we should lower the voting age to 16. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us what you think of the idea, especially if you are a teen yourself. Call 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll go to your calls now. Carlton is with us in Mount Horeb. Carlton, hi.
Good afternoon, sir, and thank you for taking my call. I think this is a really stupid idea, and I'll tell you why. I have a higher degree education than most people my age, and I can tell you from approximately sixth grade when I became politically correct until my last eighth year of college, each and every one of my instructors was a bleeding heart liberal. And what we are going to see is these young people who aren't completely developed yet in their thinking cannot make rational and informed decisions, are going to be pressured and going to be raised in the liberal fashion.
Carlton, thanks for the call. So Larry Carlton saying we have liberalism in our school districts that's going to motivate these students to vote in a particular way.
I don't think that that teachers are going to sway kids to vote in a particular way. I think that parents in such a school district would be outraged if they discovered that. Kids very often follow their parents' politics, not the politics of their teachers. It is true that in at least in the last election, the younger you were, now we're going down to 18, not 16, but the younger you were, the more likely you were to support Clinton over Trump. And the older you were, the more likely you were to support Trump over Clinton. So it is probably the case that if the voting age were lowered to 16, it would increase votes for Democratic candidates rather than Republican candidates. But of course, each political party tries to make arguments for why certain groups should or shouldn't be encouraged to vote on the basis of the demography of voting. So, I mean, this caller's point, needs to be contrasted with the strategies of right-wing individuals who themselves try to stop certain groups of people from voting because they don't like the way they vote.
Carlton, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Chris on the line in Columbus. Chris, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I agree with the previous caller. This is not a good idea. And contrast it with things that are going on in our society today. You can't drink until you're 21. They're talking about raising the age of firearm purchase to 21. The age of majority was 21 until the 1960s. Adolescents do not have the perspective of time or the grasp of the understanding of the mechanisms of government in order to make electoral decisions. And I'll tell you, you can buy a gun at 18, but a vote has a wider and longer lasting impact than a bullet.
Chris, thanks for the call. Let's start with that point that he made that people at 16 say don't have the perspective of time to make an informed decision, Larry.
Well, it seems obvious to me that the longer you're alive, the better your time perspective is going to be. And by this gentleman's argument, we shouldn't maybe let people vote until they're 80 years old. So the question really is, what's the appropriate lower age boundary? The country didn't fall apart when the voting age was lowered from 21 to 18. And as I said before, no one ever seems to pay attention to it. We have plenty of different ages at which we allow people to do different things. So just because we don't allow people to buy alcohol at a certain age doesn't mean that that needs to be what the voting age is.
Right, and that goes back to the two different types of thinking you were talking about earlier.
That's right.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Dan is with us now in Eau Claire. Dan, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I agree with the first two callers, although I come from it from a little different perspective. I'm someone who has a hard time understanding why college students who come to Eau Claire can vote on, I don't mind them voting on state issues or federal issues, but when they're starting to vote on local referendum that's going to cost a taxpayer who lives in the city more, I think that's wrong if they don't have permanent residence in Eau Claire. And the same would go with 16-year-olds who I think are going to be very influenced by a lot of information about smaller class sizes, more offerings in school, let's do this, let's raise this. I think they're just going to go for it as, yeah, let's do it. And they don't have any skin in the game. They will benefit by it, but not be a taxpayer.
Dan, thanks for the call. No skin in the game for people who are 16 or 17, he says, Larry.
Yeah, there are lots of people that don't have skin in the game on one issue or another who are permitted to vote. There are lots of people, we don't tie voting to paying taxes in this country. So you don't have to earn income if you're an adult and pay taxes on it in order to be allowed to vote. So I don't really buy that particular argument. As for the influenceability of kids, I would only say that if you just look at television during an election cycle, you will see that adults are very influenced by the pleas and the marketing efforts of political parties as well. So it's not like adolescents have cornered the market on being susceptible to people's influence of them.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Larry Steinberg about lowering the voting age to 16. He's a professor of psychology at Temple University. Back to your calls now. Cindy is with us in New Berlin. Cindy, hi.
Hello.
What do you think?
Well, I have worked in high schools for 20-some years, and what I have noticed is that these students definitely do vote the way their parents do. It's really not a peer pressure thing. It's a family pressure thing. And I believe that 16, 17-year-olds should definitely have a vote, at least in their school board elections. And to your other guest, teachers are not allowed to share their political views with their students, period.
Cindy, thanks for the call. Cindy, open the idea, especially Larry, when it comes to school board elections, where kids do have some skin in the game, I guess.
Yeah, they do. They do. And if they are able to gather and process information about what the issues are facing a school board, I don't see any reason why they shouldn't be able to vote on it. Can I just sort of step back for
sure.
a second and say that, at least in the first couple of callers, this is the kind of gut emotional response that this idea typically elicits. I was happy to hear from this last caller, not simply because she agrees with me, at least about local elections, but because at least there's some thought behind it. I think for a lot of adults, there's just this gut reaction that people this age are simply too young to be able to do this sort of thing. There were comments posted on the New York Times website suggesting that the op-ed was the stupidest thing that had ever been published in the paper. They typically would add that that was a pretty low bar. And I just would encourage your listeners who are skeptical to just step back a little bit and just think about this and think about whether about what abilities are necessary to make an informed choice when you're voting, and ask yourself whether you think that the typical high school senior, for example, does not have these abilities.
Thanks, Cindy, for the call. Go next to Jasmine on the line in Platteville. Jasmine, hi.
Hi there.
What do you think, Jasmine?
I think it's a great idea to let 16-year-olds vote. We let them drive. So I think it would be silly to think that they wouldn't be thoughtful about their futures if given the chance to actually have a say.
Jasmine, thanks for the call. Larry, so Jasmine's saying they would actually step up and maybe be more thoughtful if they had that opportunity to vote.
Well, perhaps, let's just say as thoughtful as adults. The other point that I made it before, but I don't want to let it go, unnoticed, is that this is an opportunity for schools where 16 and 17-year-olds are captive, not to influence the way that students vote, but to educate them about government and about the importance of voting. And I think that by doing that, this will have a tremendous impact. The combination of doing that and allowing 16 and 17-year-olds to vote will really help civic engagement in this country, which is really at a very, very low level.
Time for one more call. Thanks, Jasmine. Marty with us in Lake Geneva. Marty, hi.
Hi, thank you. You know, we are now finding how intelligent 1-year-olds are, 2-year-olds are. I am all for 16-year-olds voting. We discount their intelligence just because of the number that they're 16. I mean, 18, we can shove them off to different countries and they can go kill people. Come on. You know, they are well-equipped to understand the vagaries of voting and act accordingly. I'm all for it.
Marty, thanks for the call. So, Larry, as we wrap up, are we just on that gut level, as you're talking about, underestimating our 16 and 17-year-olds?
I think we are, and I think the discussion is made confusing by comparing the different kinds of things that we allow people to do at different ages, because as I argued in the Times essay, different sorts of decisions about drinking, about driving, about using a firearm require different kinds of skills and abilities. And I think the ones that voting requires are ones that 16 and 17-year-olds have.
We'll leave it there for now. Larry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, thank you.
We've been talking to Lawrence Steinberg. He's a professor of psychology at Temple University. He's an expert on adolescence. He's the author of the book Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. He joined us today to talk about his New York Times piece titled Why We Should Lower the Voting Age to 16. Still time for you to share your thoughts on this topic. You can tweet us. We are at Central Time WPR. It's an age-old philosophical question. What is the sound of one hand clapping? Well, here it is. Okay, technically it's the sound of one hand clapping against a bunch of other hands. 295 of them, in fact. It was part of an attempt to set a new world record in Milwaukee for the most high fives in 1 minute. It was all put together by OnMilwaukee.com and the Milwaukee Admirals, and it took some setting up. Back in October, OnMilwaukee's Molly Snyder and her sons Kai and Levi filed their request to the, you know, the Guinness Records people. Their goal was to beat the previous high-five record, one person high-fiving 290 people in 1 minute. That was set in Oakland. At the Admirals game this weekend, Levi ran for it, high-fiving a line of almost 300 people. Milwaukee now holds the high-five record, provisionally, pending official approval from Guinness. Let's try to set a record of our own now. I'm going to high-five the microphone. You high-five your speaker. There's no way we're going to be able to count how many people join in, but we're going to set the instantaneous record for high-fives. Ready? 3, 2, 1, high-five. There we go. Record set. I don't think I'm going to be able to convince the Guinness people. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.